Part 3. Test 3. Question 1. We have had our zero-sort recycling system in place for several months now, and the feedback from residents has been very positive. People seem to appreciate the speed and efficiency of the new approach to recycling. Despite this early success, we need to resolve one problem that may prevent the process from working even better. The larger cardboard items which come from time to time. Larger pieces of cardboard, larger than 2 feet by 2 feet, have a way of gumming up the works, so to speak, as the compactor operates. Therefore, we would appreciate it if residents flatten and cut up their larger pieces of cardboard into pieces smaller than 2 feet by 2 feet before placing them into the chute at the recyclables compactor. This will help reduce the risk of blockages in the chute and resulting delays. Question 2. Today, professional sports television contracts make millions of dollars for sports leagues and teams alike. Advertising support is the key to these contracts, as advertisers pay a television network for airtime, and the television network then pays the league or team for broadcast rights. Advertising support has also made it possible for teams to expand the length of their seasons, pay ever-increasing player salaries, play games against teams that would have been too costly to play without support, and even move teams to larger, more profitable places. In addition, televising sporting events has influenced how each sport is played. Television timeouts, when advertising can be aired, have been added, changing the pace of the game. Game locations and times are also changed so that networks can get the biggest viewing audience, thereby charging more for advertising during the game. Question 3. Many people seem to think that a universal conception of morality requires that we find moral principles that admit of no exceptions. For instance, if it is truly wrong to lie, it must always be wrong to lie, and if one can find a single exception, any notion of moral truth must be abandoned. But the existence of moral truth does not require that we define morality in terms of invariable moral principles. Morality could be a lot like chess. There are surely principles that generally apply, but they might admit of important exceptions. If you want to play good chess, a principle like don't lose your queen is almost always worth following. But it admits of exceptions. Sometimes sacrificing your queen is a brilliant thing to do. Occasionally, it is the only thing you can do. Question 4. Extraordinarily successful people launch their year by taking time out to plan their time off. Why? They know they'll need it, and they know they'll be able to afford it. In truth, the most successful simply see themselves as working between vacations. On the other hand, the least successful don't reserve time off because they don't think they'll deserve it or be able to afford it. By planning your time off in advance, you are, in effect, managing your work time around your downtime instead of the other way around. You're also letting everyone else know well in advance when you'll be out so they can plan accordingly. When you intend to be successful, you start by protecting time to recharge and reward yourself. Question 5. The individual interactions children experience each day help them create a unique mental map of the social environment. That is, children mentally chart their experiences and make note of which behaviors make them feel guilty, which make them feel good, which are rewarded and which are not, and under what circumstances those conditions apply. Gradually, this map grows in breadth and complexity. Over time, children catalog a growing number of experiences and make finer discriminations among events. They draw on information extracted from these episodes to fit their behavior to situational demands rather than depending on other people to direct them at that moment. In addition, their increased developmental competence enables them to interpret more accurately the cues they receive and to imagine more varied responses to those cues. As a result, they become progressively more successful in monitoring their own behavior. Question 6. The room was pretty filled. More people came in all the time and stood around against the walls. Some would start dancing with each other or see someone they knew and start talking. Before we knew it, Aunt May was on the floor dancing with that woman who walked home with us after the night we saw Bobby Lee. Aunt May took the man's part, and she was swinging the woman all over. The band was playing a song I always heard on the radio. When they saw what Aunt May and the woman were doing, the other dancers moved back in a circle and let them have the whole floor. Mother and I stood up on our chairs to see over the heads of all the people who had crowded around the floor. They were calling, "Look at Flora," which was the name of the other woman, and "Swing her, Miss Gebler," and "Look at those two go." Question 7. If Shakespeare hadn't chosen writing as a profession, he probably would have become one of history's greatest psychologists or philosophers. It was his keen insight into human behavior that made his writing so powerful. In his famous verse, he's simply telling us to be authentic, to be real persons instead of the fake ones we're so often tempted to be. Honesty is a choice. When we make that choice, not in a particular set of circumstances, but as a way of life, we begin to understand what it means to be an authentic person. We become what we were meant to be. Something happens inside of us, but we can't explain it to anyone else. We just feel something unbelievably good, and we begin to respect ourselves. And because it feels so good to be authentic, it necessarily follows that we'll be true to others. Question 8. The role of music in stimulating the creative unconscious is supported by several research studies. In one experiment, adults scored higher on a test of pictorial creativity when they were exposed to background music. In two other studies, subjects who were allowed to listen to music told more fanciful stories and wrote more creative compositions than individuals working in silence. It appears that music has unique properties that unlock the floodgates to new thoughts and insights. So-called primitive cultures recognize the power of music and use ritual drumming, chanting, and singing to put tribal members into trance-like states that radically alter their thinking processes. Question 9. An old Scottish woman lived in the most miserable conditions. Years before, her son had moved to America. There he had become a very successful businessman, but had never found time to return home to visit his mother. One day, a friend sat talking with the old lady in her tiny, poorly furnished cottage. "Doesn't your son ever send you money to help with your needs?" she inquired. "No," the woman shook her head sadly. "He does write me nice letters, though, and he sends me the most interesting pictures." The listener was annoyed, realizing that the son was quite wealthy. But instead of speaking her mind, she simply said, "May I see the pictures?" The aged mother proudly brought them out of a drawer. To her visitor's amazement, they were not pictures at all. They were banknotes from America, amounting to thousands of dollars. Question 10. Henri Bergson was one of the most influential French philosophers of his time. Born in France in 1859, he was the son of an English mother and a Polish father. His early intellectual interests lay in mathematics, at which he excelled. Despite this, he took up philosophy as a career, initially teaching in schools. When his book Matter and Memory was published in 1896, he was elected to the Collège de France and became a university lecturer. He also had a successful political career and represented the French government during the establishment of the League of Nations in 1920. His work was widely translated and influenced many other philosophers and psychologists, including William James. He was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1927 and died in 1941 at the age of 81. Question 11. Art Show and Student Art Prize 2015. The 2015 Art Show opens on Monday, 24 August, 7 to 9 p.m. Parents, friends, and students are warmly invited to attend and celebrate the outstanding achievements of all visual arts, visual design, and photographic students on this night. There will also be musical performances provided by our talented students. The Student Art Prize 2015 winners with great cash prizes will also be announced. Note that the competition is available to all students across the school, not just those studying visual arts subjects, and can be completed as a drawing, photograph, painting, or digital work. Entries for this competition close on 21 August. Entry forms can be obtained from the Visual Arts Department. The art show opening is a wonderful night, not to be missed. We hope to see you there. Awards and speeches will begin at 7:30 p.m. sharp. Question 12. 2015 Summer School Classes at Eastlake High School. Eastlake High School is offering 2015 summer school classes through IOA, Indiana Online Academy. Information about Summer IOA. Course content is delivered online with opportunities to communicate with the instructor throughout the summer session. These online classes allow flexible hours that enable students to travel and participate in other activities over the summer. The registration period is April 13 to June 5, 2015. All registration is conducted online at www.eastlakehighschool.org. Students can enroll in up to two courses from the listing of the summer course offerings. The summer session begins June 8. All coursework must be completed by July 17. Computer-based final exams will be held July 20 to 23, 2015, at Eastlake High School. The exam schedule will be determined closer to the start of summer school. Question 13. Library activities of parents and other adults. The above graph shows the percentage of some library activities of parents of minor children and other adults with no child, hereafter other adults, in the past 12 months. These parents were more likely than other adults to visit the library, to browse shelves, or to borrow print books. The percentage of other adults who browsed shelves in the library was twice as high as that of other adults who borrowed DVDs, CDs, or videotapes in the library. Approximately two-thirds of the parents visited the library to attend classes or events for children, compared with roughly one-third of other adults. In the case of borrowing e-books, both parents of minor children and other adults took up the smallest proportion, with 9% and 5% respectively. Question 14. The activity of art is based on the fact that a man is capable of experiencing the emotion which moved the man who expressed it. To take the simplest example, one man laughs and another who hears becomes merry, or a man weeps and another who hears feels sorrow. A man is excited or annoyed, and another man seeing him comes to a similar state of mind. By his movements or by the sounds of his voice, a man expresses courage and determination, or sadness and calmness, and this state of mind passes on to others. A man suffers, expressing his sufferings by groans and fits, and this suffering transmits itself to other people. A man expresses his feeling of admiration, devotion, fear, respect, or love to certain objects, persons, or phenomena, and others are infected by the same feelings of admiration, devotion, fear, respect, or love to the same objects, persons, and phenomena. Question 15. One of the greatest challenges to critical thinking is the temptation to stop inquiring when you find a knowledgeable person who supports your bias. The temptation will be especially strong when that person is the first one you encounter. You will want to say, "This is the definitive answer. Case closed." If you follow this inclination, you will play down the issue and cheat yourself of genuine understanding. An issue is, by definition, a matter about which informed, careful thinkers may disagree. A word of caution is in order here. To say that it is important to examine both sides of an issue does not mean that both sides are equal in merit. Often there will be enough merit on each side to make judgment difficult, but that never justifies the avoidance of judgment. Question 16. If you state a fact and prove it, you are demonstrating its truth, but you are not arguing. If you declare a personal taste and account for it, you are sharing an opinion, but you are not arguing. Argument concerns itself with neither fact nor taste, but with that vast middle area of statements that are more or less probable. It is, for example, a fact that lakes are inland bodies of water. It is a matter of taste whether any individual likes to vacation by a lake, but it is a matter of argument whether the shore of a particular lake should be zoned for commercial or recreational development. This last issue has no one right answer. With good intent and the same facts at their disposal, reasonable people might argue on either side. But even the side that wins this argument has not established a truth, only the probable wisdom of a particular choice. Question 17. When I first lived in Saudi Arabia, I tended to answer questions in Arabic about my health, the equivalent of "how are you?" with the equivalent of my familiar routine responses of "okay" or "fine." However, I eventually noticed that when I asked a similar question, people generally answered with a phrase that had the literal meaning of "praise to God." I soon learned to use the new expression, wanting to be pragmatically appropriate in that context. My first type of answer wasn't wrong, my vocabulary and pronunciation weren't inaccurate, but it did convey the meaning that I was a social outsider who answered in an unexpected way. In other words, more was being communicated than what was being said. Initially, I did not know that. I had learned some linguistic forms in the language without learning the pragmatics of how those forms are used in a regular pattern by social insiders. Question 18. Consumerism as a way of life demands a social imagination, an ability to project how we will look and feel once we own and use goods, or what our families and friends will think of us once we do. Many people find this social tapestry woven of goods and fantasies an entertaining problem and means for self-expression. The marketplace is not merely the institution upon which we hang our economic survival, but a major source of meaning. The task of managing one's personal place within the constant flow of changes in fashion and personal styles can be a demanding yet enjoyable experience. Like a fish in water, an individual's personal and social identity is so bound up with the consumer culture that it becomes difficult to reflect on the broader question of how we came to be in this aquarium. Question 19. For many people, most of the time, the "mine is better" tendency is balanced by the awareness that other people feel the same way about their things, that it's an unavoidable part of being human to do so. In other words, many people realize that we all see ourselves in a special way, different from everything that is not ourselves, and that whatever we associate with ourselves becomes part of us in our minds. People who have this understanding and are reasonably secure and self-confident can control the tendency. The problem is, some people do not understand that each person has a special viewpoint. For them, "mine is better" is not an attitude that everyone has about his or her things. Rather, it is a special, higher truth about their particular situation. They think they have the only correct answer and want to force all others to be like them. Question 20. In an increasingly globalized world, literature in translation has an especially important role. Increasingly, writers, readers, and publishers are turning to literature as a bridge between cultures, particularly Western and Arab societies. This growing interest is, in turn, driving a boom in translation. However, not surprisingly, perhaps, Most translations are from English into other languages, not from another language, such as Arabic, into English. Hence, the huge American market is seen as driving the imbalance. Bookstores in the United States, for example, rarely stock more than Nobel Prize winner Naguib Mahfouz's Cairo Trilogy, a masterful realistic account of life in Cairo and of a merchant family in the mid-20th century. Western readers likely know little of Mahfouz's more experimental work, his political and religious allegories, or his historical dramas. The result is a kind of one-way mirror between America and the rest of the world. Question 21. What is geography? Literally, geography means description of the Earth. The Earth is full of various things, and it is difficult to study in isolation. In fact, the Earth is synonymous with the world, which is again rich with various things. If we take to describing everything that we find on the Earth, it will be difficult to come out with a definition. We have to focus on certain important things and leave out unimportant ones. In order to come to this position, we have to come forward with certain principles which help us to study the Earth with its relevant factors. In fact, we study the Earth as the home of man. It will therefore be quite proper to define geography as the study of the Earth as the home of man, or the study of the environment of man, particularly in its relation to human activities. Question 22. People with a lower rate of idea flow can be just as creative as people with a fast flow. It simply means that the ideas come more slowly. Often the best ideas come from thinking things out carefully. People with lower idea flow can concentrate their energies on a particular task for a longer period of time. You'll find these people in business management, fine art printing, and accounting, all fields needing an ability to focus. For many jobs in the business world, a rapid flow of ideas is a hindrance. Thomas Edison experimented with hundreds of filaments before he came up with one that led to the light bulb. Someone with high idea flow might have given up and gone on to other projects. Question 23. There might be many different reasons why faces seem naturally interesting and eye-catching to humans. The widely accepted theory is that an infant's attraction to faces emerges as an adaptive mechanism to promote parent-child attachment. Being able to recognize and engage the primary caregiver increases the likelihood that an infant will become emotionally bonded with that individual and receive proper nurturance. The need to recognize, engage, and extract information from faces continues, of course, through childhood and into adulthood. Being able to read the minds of others in a social group is also important for survival and reproductive success. Humans can't read minds, but the next best thing is being able to understand the emotional mindset of your peers. No other body part even comes close to yielding such rich emotional information about the bearer, as is the case with the face. Questions 24 and 25. One day, an old man came home to discover that his flower garden had been broken into. He was exceptionally fond of gardening and extremely upset that someone would ruin his masterpiece and show such complete disregard for his dedication. So he kept watching until the offender returned. Expecting a neighborhood wanderer, he was surprised the next afternoon when a group of four adolescents showed up carrying a football and began playing two-on-two in his backyard. His flower garden was the end zone. As the old man watched, he noticed that the boys took immense joy in diving into the end zone to make spectacular catches. The flowers were not something to be vandalized. Rather, they were the goal of great play, respected almost. The old man was now more curious than furious. Though he still wanted to stop the destruction of his flowers, he decided he would conduct an experiment. He went outside and called the boys over. He explained that he too loved the flower garden and wished to reward the boys for their play. He said he would provide them each with a dollar every day so that they would come to his lawn. At first, it was a marvelous treat. The kids felt like professional athletes being played to play sports. But interestingly, as the old man reduced his reward in the following weeks, the boys showed up with less frequency. In fact, they became disturbed that they were no longer being paid what they were worth. Questions 26 through 28. Although concert pianist Lang Lang was promoted as a symbol of the youth and future of China in Beijing's opening ceremony for the 2008 Summer Olympics, he had almost given up on his dream of being a pianist. When he was a child in Beijing, where he had moved in order to study piano, Lang Lang went through a time of estrangement from his father after his piano teacher had unfairly criticized him and he declined to play the piano. While he was in trouble with his father, Lang Lang once wandered through an outdoor market where he saw a fruit vendor with watermelons for sale. Lang Lang did not have any money, but he picked up and held a watermelon that he wished he had money to buy. The fruit vendor saw him and said, "The way you're caressing that melon, it's as if you're playing a musical instrument. Most people just poke at it." Lang Lang explained that he used to play the piano, but had stopped. The fruit vendor joked, "You look too young to be retired." Lang Lang explained, "I had a teacher who said I wasn't very talented." The fruit vendor replied, "Teachers can be wrong. I think you must play beautifully." Lang Lang asked, "How do you know?" The fruit vendor explained, "I can hear you in my imagination. And I look at your hands and fingers." He then gave Lang Lang a watermelon, saying, "This watermelon is not for sale. I was saving it as a gift for a great musician. This is your reward for having practiced so long and hard. This is your prize." The fruit vendor's name was Han. Soon he became a friend of the family, and Lang Lang called him Uncle Number Two. And soon Lang Lang started playing the piano again. Another thing that helped Lang Lang to start playing the piano again was a letter from the children in a choir he had been accompanying. They told him how talented he was, and they sent him a toy, a transformer, as a gift to show their appreciation.